Okay, everyone. We're quarter past the hour, so in keeping with the schedule, I know some people have stepped out to get a coffee. Just to remind everyone, we will have a 15-minute break following this session, so opportunity again to get something to drink and use the restroom. The restrooms are just right outside the doors. So just to keep things running on schedule, we'll start things off with the update on digital assets.
All right, thanks for coming, everybody. I think we're just going to introduce ourselves as we go. We're here to discuss digital assets, probably on everybody's mind recently. My name is Jaime Soto. I'm a manager in the compliance department. I focus mainly on disclosure documents and promotional material. And we're just going to jump right into it. So just to give you an idea of the number of firms that are engaging in this digital asset activity at NFA members, we have about 370 members that have told us that they're trading digital asset derivatives of some kind, and about 150 members that are doing spot trading of digital assets. It's growing every day. So just to go right into it, so NFA Interpretive Notice 9073 discusses required disclosures for firms engaging in digital asset activities. And just for starters, FCMs and IBs have to provide written disclosures to any customer before any transactions are made. Have to provide NFA and CFTC advisories, which are basically electronic pamphlets, before engaging in any trades for customers. CTAs and CPOs that want to offer trading in derivatives or in the spot digital assets have to provide disclosures in their offering documents, disclosure documents, any promotional material. There are certain required disclosures that have to be included. And there is no prescribed language for what you have to discuss, but it really should be tailored to your circumstances, to what you're offering, the product that you're offering. There is a suggested list in the interpretive notice of the topics that you should be discussing, the risks or areas of concern. You know, just a few of them, the extremely volatile nature of the markets, issues with valuation, cybersecurity in particular, maintaining wallet integrity, or how wallet security, passphrase security, how the spot market isn't exactly clear how people transact in it, or whether there is any fraud going on behind the scenes, the changing regulatory landscape. Just there's if you go to the interpreter notes, there's a list, and it really it was written with the idea that you would have to tailor it to what you're doing, to your specific situation. There is a disclosure, a block disclosure, if you're engaging in spot activity, that you have to include in anything that promotes or solicits that product, and that has to be included. It has to be verbatim, and it's for any type of member, any registration category, you have to include this disclaimer. But as far as what you're disclosing in your offering documents or in your promotional material, it should really be tailored to what the specific product that you're offering. So as far as what you're required to disclose to us, it's very minimal at the moment. And I think we're just at this stage, we just want to get an idea of the kind of activity that you're doing. So there's a section in the NFA annual questionnaire for every member to fill out regarding digital asset activity. It's just basic questions about whether you're trading it, if you have a pool or operating a pool, or you're offering derivatives or spot trading. And we usually reach out to you once you complete the questionnaire and you indicate that you're doing something involving digital assets, we'll reach out to you just to get a better idea of what you're doing. Like I said, right now it's more of we want to have an idea of, it's really broad, the kinds of activities that we've seen member firms engaging in. It's just, there's a lot out there, and we're trying to get an idea of what members are doing. So we'll probably reach out to you and get an idea of what you're trading, where you're trading it, who you're trading with. And please, you should just expect us to reach out to you. So, and there's also the pool questionnaire. So, you know, the annual questionnaire is for the firm, and each individual pool has its own questionnaire that you have to complete. And you have to indicate things like the percentage of the assets of the pool that you're using to trade digital assets or digital asset derivatives. We'll reach out just to get more information, just to, so you have an idea of how many pools. I think it's about 700 commodity pools that we know are engaging in some form of digital asset activity. And it's growing every day. So as far as actually disclosing your holdings in the quarterly pool filings, those, the PQR form itself, I think is not easy for us to get changed. You know, like there's a schedule of investments that you have to, where you have to indicate, like, as of the end of the quarter, you're holding these assets. There isn't a place there for digital assets. So what we've been doing is we've actually been asking members to include it in the alternative investments section. It's just this section is other. So it's boxes 6273 and 6274. So whatever your digital asset holdings as of the end of the quarter, that's where we ask that you, for now, that's where we ask that you include it. And as far as when something goes wrong, if there's a market event, something that causes you to maybe not be able to meet your margin call if you're operating a pool, or you know, suspend redemptions, you know, their interpretive notice 250 requires that you, in the case of a market event like that, if that affects your pool in a material way, you have to submit a notice filing to NFA basically within a day, by 5 p.m. the following business day. And it's, if it's whether it's, if you, your pool is subject to one of the four conditions that are in, that are listed in the interpretive notice, you know, if once you submit your filing, we'll reach out to you for more information. But, you know, in case you encounter some difficulty in digital asset trading, you are required to submit a notice filing. That's it for me, and I'm going to turn it over to Marcus.
Hi, everyone. My name is Marcus Michelson. I'm a manager in NFA's OTC derivatives group in the models and risk subgroup. I'm going to talk about swap dealers and digital asset activity. NFA is aware that swap dealer members may engage in digital asset related business activity, including swaps activity that references digital assets or other digital asset linked derivatives. As a reminder, these activities bring new risks that are unique to this asset class. Also, the risks associated with digital assets may not have yet fully come to light. NFA has recently updated our annual questionnaire for swap dealers to include two questions, requesting that swap dealers disclose their digital asset related activities. The first question has to do with derivatives that reference digital assets, and the second question has to do with spot digital asset activity. We're also requesting that swap dealers disclose planned future activity as part of the questionnaire. In our ongoing exams, one of the examination steps is the preliminary questionnaire. We typically include these questions in the preliminary questionnaire as well. To give you an overview of what we have seen so far, out of 67 corporate families, 22 have indicated some touch point with digital assets, either swaps, spots, or other business activity. 22 of those are, 20 of those, the touch point there is derivative products, primarily in the CME futures and options space. Four swap dealers have transacted in NDFs that are referencing digital assets. We see four more that have some planned activity for NDFs. We saw two swap dealers who have some spot digital assets. Six swap dealers have begun or plan to begin some form of crypto custody service. And four swap dealers have begun or plan to participate in developing some form of e-money, stablecoin, or on-chain payment system. And lastly, we have one so-called crypto native swap dealer registrant. So that's kind of a high-level overview of what we've collected so far in terms of information on swap dealers' touch points with digital assets. Please be aware that NFA is collecting this information. Respond fully to the preliminary questionnaire when it's provided as part of an exam, and update your annual questionnaires as appropriate. As a reminder, swap dealers conducting business activity in digital assets have to apply, of course, the current rules to any new products. To do so, swap dealers have to identify the risks associated with those digital activities and assess the impacts of those risks on your ability to comply with the CFTC regulations, NFA requirements. Those may include material information disclosures. Currently, ISDA, of course, has created standardized disclosures for material information. These disclosures are not going to cover digital assets, as they're not one of the product types that was taken into account for those disclosures. There are also requirements under 23600 to identify, manage, and monitor the risks associated with the swaps activities. Digital assets may introduce new risks that require new controls, monitoring routines in the risk management programs. Lastly, swap dealers should consider any impact that digital asset-related swaps may have on compliance with the margin requirements and the capital requirements. One more item that we've come across and NFA is taking a closer look at is swap dealers participating in combined user interfaces with non-NFA members. This is a combined user interface that offers customers or counterparties access to digital asset markets. Swap dealers need to ensure that the users of these interfaces are aware when they're transacting via this interface with a regulated NFA member entity, or whether that transaction is ending up with a non-regulated counterparty. So that's what I have. Thank you very much, and I think we'll take questions after the panel.
Thanks, Marcus. My name is Nick Schendel. I'm a manager in NFA's compliance department. My name is Nick Schendel. I'm a manager in NFA's compliance department, focusing on examinations out of Chicago. I'm going to speak a little bit about NFA's new compliance rule 251. So as Jaime previously discussed, over 300 members have reported to NFA that they engage in digital asset derivatives and or spot activities, with the exception of NFA's interpretive notice regarding disclosure requirements. NFA does not have any rule that specifically addresses a member's conduct while engaging in digital asset activity. The daily news and CFTC and SEC enforcement dockets provides strong evidence that there is a significant amount of fraudulent activity in this spot in digital asset markets. Currently, if an NFA member commits fraud or acts inconsistently with just and equitable principles of trade in these markets, NFA would only have jurisdiction if the activity was related to digital asset derivatives, but not if the business involves spot digital assets. As such, in February of 2023, NFA's board approved NFA Compliance Rule 251. It has been submitted to the CFTC, and a notice to members should be issued shortly with the effective date of this rule. Compliance Rule 251 is modeled after NFA's other anti-fraud rules, Compliance Rule 22, which covers exchange-traded futures and options, and Compliance Rule 236, which covers retail forex. Compliance Rule 251 will apply to all NFA membership categories, including swap dealers. And Currently, Compliance Rule 251 specifically limits its coverage to digital assets defined as commodities, which at this time is Bitcoin and Ether. If any other digital assets are identified as commodities in the future, NFA could amend the rule to include these digital assets as well. Compliance Rule 251 has five sections. The first it covers fraud and related matters, so it just goes through a listing of things that the members can't do, so no member engaged in these activities should cheat, defraud, or deceive another person, disseminate false or misleading information, or engage in manipulative acts regarding the price of a digital asset commodity. They should not embezzle or steal any money, securities, or digital assets received in relation to digital asset transactions. The second portion is just and equitable principles of trade, which just requires all firms to observe high standards of commercial honor when conducting digital asset commodity transactions. The third is disclosure and related matters. So this just reiterates that all members engaged in this activity must comply with the requirements of Interpretive Notice 9073, which Jaime previously discussed. The fourth is probably the most important portion of this new rule, and that is the supervision, which requires that all firms diligently supervise any employees responsible for digital asset commodity activity. And finally, the last section covers the scope of the rule, which, as I previously mentioned, is currently just Bitcoin and Ether, as those are the only digital assets currently defined as commodities. So that's Compliance Rule 251. I'm going to pass it on to Jim, who's going to talk about stuff we're seeing on exams.
Yes, thank you, Nick. please let me know if you can't hear me. So what I'm going to talk about is what we're seeing on exams. So we've been conducting exams. We've been going out to firms, and you know, we've completed a bunch of exams. So these are observations and things we've seen on exams of firms in the digital asset space. So the first thing I wanted to mention is that, you know, when we go out and do exams, one of the things we commonly do, especially at CPOs, is we send confirmations. And the challenge we've been running into here is that, you know, as this space is newer, and you know, the firms tend to be newer or can be newer, we've run into challenges getting responses to confirmations. So the thing to consider is, you know, if you have funds, you know, held by another entity, you know, is that entity familiar with the confirmation process? You know, obviously these firms are not on confirmations.com, so we have to send them a paper confirmation. And what we're finding is that they're often not responsive. They don't want to respond. They can, you know, and this can put up a roadblock that we have to work our way through. And ultimately, what this does is it just delays the examination process.
Jimmy, is this one?
Oh, sorry. Is this better? Can you hear me? Thank you. Should I start over? Did enough of you hear that? Somebody could have raised their hand, by the way, just that I can't hear you. But nobody did it. So I'll just continue. So we're talking about confirmations. So when we don't get a response to a confirmation, you know, we have to work through that, and this delays the exam process. We have to get the firm involved. We have to communicate with the entity that we're trying to confirm assets with. So that delays the exam process. Everybody has to get involved. And then the other problem we run into is that, you know, if they're not familiar with what a confirmation is, often what we get back from the firm, from that, you know, whether it be a bank, a broker, or an exchange, what we'll get back, you know, is not what we were looking for. They don't know what a confirmation is, so they send us something, and now it further delays the process because, you know, we now have to figure out what they sent us. You know, and ultimately we're going to work through this because we have to, you know, get responses to our confirmations. But within the digital asset space, this is something we've been running into a problem with firms using, you know, and holding, depositing funds with entities not familiar with this process. So that's something to consider. Also on exams, when it comes to valuation, what we'll be doing is we'll be looking at your valuation policy. You know, what is the policy? You know, is it reasonable and are you following it? This is specifically to mention just with regards to illiquid and lightly traded in assets. You know, when it comes to these markets, you know, some of these investments can be, you know, they can be unique. They may not be highly traded. So how are you valuing those? What information are you using to set a market value on those for financial reporting purposes? One of the unique problems that we've run into in this when it comes to valuing assets is we've seen a timing difference that, you know, within your valuation policy, you know, these assets are traded over a the market is always open for digital assets. So the time you are going to value them, you know, we've seen where an admin does it at one time, maybe the firm does it at another, so we're getting different conflicting valuations based on what time they're pulled. So something to consider is within your valuation policy, are you pulling that valuation at a consistent time so that everybody's on the same page as to when the value of that asset is being set? That's valuation. We're also, when it comes to the use of administrators with digital asset firms, what we're seeing is that, you know, a lot of these firms tend to be newer, so they've hired an admin, and what they're doing is, you know, they're just basically relying on the admin to put the books and records together and, you know, put together the balance sheet, the income statement, you know, account statements, do all that. They have the information, but what the firms aren't doing is understanding what the admin is giving them. You know, how well do you understand your books and records? These are still your records. You need to understand them. And the better understanding you have of what the admin's doing, it helps our examination process. You know, we're going to look at the balance sheet. We're going to look at account statements and other records that the admin has put together. So how well do you understand that, and can you answer our questions? And if you can't, well, now we need to loop in the admin. And this is something that we're finding just further delays the examination process when the firm doesn't understand their books and records. Something else, it was mentioned earlier, but what is not uncommon within the digital asset space, a lot of these firms are newer, haven't been around as long. With regards to cybersecurity, you know, the challenge we run into there is just basically when we ask for a copy of their cybersecurity program, the response we get is, what is that? So it's not that it's inadequate, it's that they didn't even know the requirement existed. So, you know, if you don't know it existed, when we ask for a written policy, obviously you don't have a written one. So just, you know, that's something to be aware of. It is a requirement. We're going to ask for it, and, you know, it has to be in writing. The other thing that to keep in mind when it comes to digital asset firms is, you know, digital asset in this space, there's a higher risk profile for information technology or cybersecurity. So, you know, when we look at the program, do we see that reflected in the program? You know, have you taken into consideration all the risks that there are? The risk profile is different than a firm in a more established space that, you know, working with, you know, a lot of the exchanges, you know, the technology, it's all very new. Are you fully considering that and building that into your information system security program? So that's something. So in addition to, you know, we have our interpretive notice 9070, which will lay out the elements that we're looking for, but that's something that, you know, on top of just thinking about those required elements, are there things you need to think about and build into that program to make sure you're properly addressing those? And when we do exams of these firms, something we're seeing is when it comes to promotional material, we will look at your approval process. We want to make sure you're following it. But a couple of specific things that we've seen is, you know, are you calculating rates of return in accordance with Part 4? Are you doing it properly? Do you have documentation to support that? And then the other thing we've seen on occasion is, you know, since the firms are new, they want to use hypothetical performance because they don't have a track record. Well, can they use hypothetical performance? And if they are, do they have the required disclosures? You know, when you use hypothetical performance, the disclosures are more robust, they're more complicated, you need to put more effort and time into meeting the requirements. So just, you know, if you're going to use hypothetical performance, just be aware the requirements around disclosures are more significant. It's been covered, but something that's not uncommon with digital asset firms is registration issues. You know, are the APs registered and the PRINs listed? These firms, principals listed. Firms tend to be new, so they're not, you know, if the firm is new and the individuals are not that experienced in the industry, often we find, you know, unlisted principals, APs that aren't registered, and that's something we have to work our way through. And then finally, as far as what we're seeing on exams, similar to ISSP or cybersecurity, there's our bylaw 1101 requirement, and what I mean by that is the response we often get when we ask about that is firms, they're not aware of what it is. So, you know, we do have a bylaw 1101 requirement. You need to have bylaw 1101 procedures, and you need to document compliance with them. So this is our Know Your Customer rule. It applies to all our member firms. Like I said, what we're seeing is that firms are just not aware of this requirement at all and not doing anything in that, as far as that goes. Those are my observations as far as what we're seeing on exams. pivoting a little bit, and this is still stuff we're seeing on exams with maybe a different perspective, is with regards to risk management. In this space, what we're seeing is, you know, we may want to look at your risk assessment process. And what we mean by that is we might want to understand how you assess and understand the risks of the investment portfolio. You know, this is a new space, so it has a, you know, different risk profile. There's, you know, obviously we're all somewhat new to it. But what we would be looking for is, you know, what is the process? What information is used? Who is involved in the process? And when is it performed? You know, does the firm understand the entities they're invested in? You know, does the firm fully understand what they're investing in and where it's being held and what the risks are? You know, how does that process work? We might want to take a look at that. Specifically within this, something that we may take a look at is, you know, what are the controls around processing transactions on the blockchain? So this is a little bit risk assessment and a little bit something we're seeing on exams. But when I mentioned that, when it comes to processing transactions on the blockchain, you know, how do you know that when you go into a wallet and move funds around, what is your process to ensure that, you know, you're moving funds from wallet A to wallet B? How do you know, do you have a process to make sure you know that it gets there properly? You know, what are your controls to make sure that if I intend, you know, that I, when I send funds, it actually goes to B? Because this having a different risk profile, you know, if you send the funds to the wrong entity, you may never get them back. There's no middleman, there's no help desk, there's nobody you can call to fix this problem. So what controls do you have around that process for moving funds around on the blockchain? Something I wanted to mention briefly, we've talked, is counterparty risk. You know, this is as part of your risk assessment process. Are you considering this? You know, since this space is relatively new, you know, have you assessed the risks around holding assets at certain entities? You know, have you looked at counterparty risks? What is your process around assessing the risks at entities that are holding assets? I next wanted to talk about passwords. So from a risk standpoint, you know, passwords have a certain risk, a higher risk profile in digital assets. You know, and some things to think about are, you know, what type of storage are you using, cold versus hot, and what are the risks associated with the different types of storage for passwords or private keys? You know, you are the only person that knows that private key, so, you know, whether it be hot or cold storage, as well as, you know, secure as you think it is, something can always go wrong. And, you know, have you thought about what the risks are if you do have a problem with a key, a password, or some sort of storage device? So, you know, how do you back up passwords? What is that process? How does that work? Is it sufficient? And have you even thought through what would you do if you lost a password or access to a wallet? So, you know, there's lots of digital transactions in this space. You're doing them yourself. If something goes wrong, do you have a plan B? Have you thought that through? That's with regard to passwords. Briefly on due diligence, you know, it was mentioned earlier, so I'll just touch on it for a moment, but due diligence with regards to third-party service providers, that's something you have to have a process around that, and we will be looking at that. So that covers what I was intending to cover as far as what we're doing on exams. Just to wrap things up, kind of what's next, something that, you know, as far as we've talked about disclosures, we've talked about due diligence, but as far as disclosures go, you know, we're going to continue to review the disclosure requirements. We're going to update them as it may become necessary. For due diligence, you know, as the language changes and the industry evolves, do we need to update those requirements to keep them current and reflecting what the industry is currently doing? As far as due diligence, you know, are there other areas in which we may need to which would make sense for us to develop rules, you know, such as due diligence on custodians? You know, are there other things we need to look at as far as rulemaking to think about as this space develops, other rules we may need to implement going forward? So to just sum it up in terms of you know, as going forward, we're going to continue to review the markets and the rules and regulations to see if the existing rules need to be updated or if there is a need for a new rule going forward. I think we're open to questions now.
I just had one thing before that. For the annual questionnaire requirements, should a member firms, like businesses, change and they begin to transact in this space, they should update that annual questionnaire right when that happens and not just when their annual questionnaire is due to be updated.
So just to keep that information current so we're aware of it.
There are some products that are like mutual fund or ETF in nature that hold either spot crypto or crypto derivatives, so that you know a pool could own these instruments indirectly. What is the NFA's view on whether these types of instruments would trigger the disclosures under 9073?
We actually run into that a lot. I'd say at least half of the pools that we consider that are transacting in digital assets are doing it through another pool or through an investment in another pool. And we would, if you know that your investee pools are transacting in digital assets, you would have to disclose that to your clients in your offering documents and your promotional material. So we treat it as if that is your product and you are offering that to your clients.
Hi. In the new rule 2-51, you said that applies to swap dealers and other registrants. But then, and then on the disclosure specifically, it referenced to the interpretive rule 9073. But then if you look at 9073, it's all about registrants of non-swap dealers. So the question is on the disclosure specifically, is there any NFA-related specific disclosures for swap dealers?
Hi. There are a number of material information disclosure requirements in the business conduct standards under the CFTC regulations, and we expect swap dealers to continue to apply those requirements for any swaps related. Digital swaps that are linked to digital assets. So, you know, those include the pre-trade disclosures, the developing standardized disclosures that would be specific to digital assets, the pre-trade mid-market mark. There's other material information disclosures. So I take a look through that for the disclosure requirements.
Okay, so it's all the business conduct, external business conduct requirement under the CFTC, nothing specific from the NFA on digital assets, right?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Hi, I had a question as well for Marcus. You mentioned something about a combined user interface offering customers digital assets. Can you talk a little bit more about what NFA's expectations are there?
We currently haven't established, anything formalized in terms of expectations. But what I would like to point out right now is that there is a risk associated with using this kind of interface, and it's something that we are taking a closer look at. The risk is that the user, either a client or a counterparty, would use the interface. They would believe that they're transacting with a regulated entity and that their transaction is occurring in a regulated space, but then it will turn out that it is not because, you know, the firm may have multiple, you know, booking entities on the back end of that, on that interface, and, you know, some of those entities may be NFA members, other ones may not be. And so, you know, I think as a first step in addressing this risk, it'd be prudent to make sure that the clients or counterparties are aware when the transaction is going to a regulated entity and is falling in a regulated space and when the transaction is not.
Just a question on new registrants and digital assets. What's the expected timing for the first exam for these types of entities?
I don't know that there's a requirement with regards to timing. Our process is risk-based, so you will have an initial exam as a member, but as far as going out and us conducting a compliance examination, that's risk-based, and there is no timing set on that.
Hi, Putting together policies and procedures, do you think bylaw 1101 will have further importance in your future examinations in terms of future audits? Will that have some added emphasis? Because I'm finding that there's just a lot of players that come into inquiring about the NFA and so forth, and you have to ask the question, well, geez, I mean, should these people be registered or not? So just curious.
Yeah, so bylaw 1101 is important on all of our exams, so I don't necessarily know we would say it's more important given the digital asset space, but it certainly is a factor that should be considered by all firms when they're transacting in this space. But yeah, we're not going to say it's more important on these exams than it is, because we consider it important on all of them.
Are there any other questions?
I was thinking, is this digital assets replacing like virtual currency, or is it the same thing?
I mean, I haven't explained, I haven't to think it through in a little bit, but digital assets are just a more comprehensive way, and it's something I thought about how best to try not to interchange between digital asset and cryptocurrency, but you know, digital assets is just a more broad category of electronic or blockchain-based way of holding an asset. So, digital assets, a broader category, might include tokens, more different types of investments. Cryptocurrencies are a digital asset. They're just defined a little differently because they're more of a currency, but digital assets just a broader category.
When I heard the talk, I heard that you could engage in these different assets, but I was under the impression that you have to deal only with members, and I got kind of confused. So you can deal with that without it being a member of NFA? Am I confusing the question? I don't know.
I guess a way to respond to that would be, I mean, if you're transacting and you have to know who you're dealing with, and if they need to be an NFA member, you have to know that or not. So you can transact with somebody who's not an NFA member if they don't have to be. But if they do, you just have to know. And if they have to be an NFA member, they should be properly registered. That's the difference. So you can transact with non-NFA members as long as they don't have to be. That sums that up.
Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Go ahead, Marcus.
I just wanted to circle back on the question about NFA rules as they relate to disclosures, and just as a reminder, there are rules 2.4 and 2.22, and there's an interpretive notice to 2.49, I believe, that speaks to marketing information for swap dealers. So these are broader requirements when it comes to the combined user interface. These rules may have some bearing on what we would expect in terms of not misleading, the users of that interface. So, and that would extend beyond just the requirements in the business conduct standards section.
Thank you very much. All right, everyone, we've reached the break in the agenda. We'll pick things back up at 11:15. So we are just a little bit ahead of schedule, so a little bit longer than a 15-minute break.